Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Leute, es wird unangenehm, denn ich muss euch einfach fragen, habt ihr euch eigentlich schon mal um eure Versicherung gekümmert? Hier ist übrigens Tara vom Podcast Tara sagt was und ich sage euch, es wird allerhöchste Zeit, Ordnung in euer Versicherungschaos zu bringen und dabei kann euch die App Clark helfen. Da arbeiten ganz viele Expertinnen, die das hauptberuflich machen, man glaubt es kaum. Und mit meinem Code TARA60, alles groß und zusammengeschrieben, könnt ihr euch sogar einen Shopping-Gutschein sichern, 60 Euro, bei zum Beispiel Amazon oder Douglas einlösbar, mit dem Code TARA60.
The world is facing a shortage of tradespeople. The metaverse can help solve that problem. With a virtual reality training platform developed by ForgeFX, aspiring welders can practice over and over. As a result, students learn the specialized skills they need to begin and advance welding careers. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
From the BBC World Service, this edition of the documentary podcast is the fourth of four programmes, Forward Thinking. We're here at the Oxford Literary Festival with The Telegraph. I'm Nuala McGovern. And my guest this hour is AI ethicist Kerry McInerney. We will be taking questions from our live audience in the room and those who got in touch online as we discuss ideas that could transform our world. And in the magnificent setting of this prestigious university that's almost 1,000 years old, we're going to discuss some very modern issues, the challenges posed by new technologies and the possible solutions. I want to begin, Kerry, and welcome, to ask you, how can feminism fix the internet? What do you mean by that?
I would say that I don't think feminism necessarily can fix the problems we see on the internet, because I think fix implies this quick one-off solution that once we apply something, everything will be okay. And I think we see this fix-it mindset in the tech industry broadly when we look at things like de-biasing AI programs or trying to introduce safeguards around internet platforms. But rather than saying feminism can fix the internet, I do think feminism can transform it, and that if we draw on feminist ideas, principles, knowledges, histories, we can use those to create an internet that is safer and more equitable.
But what do we mean about being safe online?
One way that I like to think about it is, where do you feel safe walking alone, for example, if you leave your house? The places where I think I feel safe walking alone is very different to where my husband feels safe walking alone. And the internet is the same for many people. For some people, using the internet is free and it's easy. And for others, you think very carefully and consciously about what you post online, how you engage online. And I don't know if you've experienced this as a journalist, but women journalists, for example, as a demographic, is one particular demographic that tends to experience a lot of harm and violence and unsafety online.
It's so interesting. I think that image of walking down the street at night, maybe we'll just do it with the audience, a dark street, or maybe a street near your house, but it's late. Would you walk down it without a care in the world? Who would walk down it without a care in the world? Interesting. Mainly it is the women that are not putting their hands up, although there are some women that have, but definitely there's a gender divide there. Do you feel it's different being a woman online than a man?
Absolutely. And I think that the data we have also backs that up. 58% of women and girls have experienced some kind of cyber harassment or violence online. And something that's very important to me is not saying that this is an entirely new problem, but rather looking at the continuity or the spectrum between the kinds of violence that women and girls have long experienced offline and the way that new technologies amplify those, or they provide people with new tools, but with very similar and far-reaching consequences. Because I think 10 years ago, people didn't take violence against women and girls on the internet very seriously. They said, well, that's not the real world. That's a virtual world. And so it's very different to feeling unsafe in your home or on the streets. But for many of us, technology is so imbricated in our daily life that if we don't feel safe using the internet or using different platforms, that really impacts our quality of life very substantially.
Yes, because sometimes what comes up is people say, well, just turn it off. Don't use it. Block that person or just delete that app that might be causing the issue. And maybe we should get into some real world examples as well. I came across the term, this was new for me actually, technology facilitated gender-based violence, TFGBV. How do you understand that term?
Yes, so this is a very broad umbrella term that is used to refer to all the different ways that new technologies are used to enact forms of gender-based violence. So one that you're probably seeing on the news a lot right now is deepfake technology or the use of generative AI to create material that is harmful or abusive towards women and people of minoritized genders. But another way that we can also think about this is the use of more mundane or accepted technologies, things like the Internet of Things, that includes smart home devices to control and harass partners in the home.
So let's stop on that. I think let's break them both down, actually. Why don't we? Deepfakes, there was actually an investigation recently that found, 4,000 images. They were celebrities actually from around the world that had basically been placed in pornographic images with deepfakes of their faces that were superimposed on it. And this was a huge investigation that had taken place, and it was a global investigation. Talk me through the ramifications of that, perhaps, before we move on to the Internet of Things.
What I see deepfakes doing is extending this realm of gender-based violence that we call intimate image abuse, or the use of people's nude photographs, their pictures of their body, and disseminating them widely online to strangers without their consent. And why I think deepfakes are particularly harmful is not because it's a new kind of abuse per se, but because it just makes those tools much more widely accessible. And I think sometimes the technological fixes we try to apply to deepfakes don't necessarily grapple with the real harms of this when it comes to gender-based violence. So sometimes I see people saying what we really need is a watermark or a tool that will tell us when something is fake. And that's valuable when it comes to things like election disinformation or political news. But the problem with an intimate image abuse deepfake is, to some extent, harm has already happened. So if we take, for example, the Taylor Swift deepfakes that came out, which showed...
Can you explain that a little bit further?
Yeah, so very recently, unfortunately, there were some pornographic images created with deepfakes of the famous pop singer Taylor Swift. People were saying, oh, it's really harmful that we can have these fake images made, so we need to be able to know which are real and which are fake. To which I would say, well, actually, the harm's already been done. There's already these very explicit images of Taylor Swift being circulated. And so having a little watermark saying these are fake images is not necessarily going to help her, the victim, in this scenario.
What would you suggest then, using a feminist lens in a situation like that?
On the one hand, I think we need to go back to the work of civil society organizations and feminist activists who've been working for a very long time on the issue of intimate image abuse and has been trying to get people to take it seriously. On the other hand, I think sometimes we need to move the question away from what new or exciting or terrifying thing can this technology do, to what encourages people psychologically, socially, politically to use a technology in this way. So when it comes to things like disinformation broadly, I think often we ask, how can AI help us create and disseminate forms of misinformation, and why is this dangerous? Those are really good questions, but I think we have to ask the further question, which is, what makes people really vulnerable to disinformation in the first place? What makes people desire to create disinformation? What kinds of political circumstances does that serve? And I think when we take those kinds of questions together, we can reach a solution that isn't just technological, but is also political, and again, can be more fundamentally transformative.
You're just reminding me of a comment that came in. This is from Adam Blanford. He says, hate or appearing to hate is now a career choice for some, as it's proved to be financially rewarding. Clickbait button pressing continues to fund and fuel the ego of too many unsavory individuals, reduce the income stream, and the origin of so much division and peddled hate would leave the scene. I read that because I'm just thinking of, you're talking about the motivation for that person to do what they're doing.
Yes, I mean, I think this comment is really crucial, and it speaks to the economic model that lies at the heart of so many social media platforms. We've seen this certainly with X or Twitter and with Meta, where there's been real horrific world harms related to these models of clickbait capitalism. Unfortunately, the videos that get the most traction are always the one where someone has said something rude in the comments, or it's when there's some kind of controversy. And because that's what these tools are designed to do, they're designed to maximize engagement without much of a mind towards ethics.
And we will come back to the responsibilities of big tech. I know with the deepfake story what they will always say, and I don't have any representatives of the companies here, but they say that they have protections in place, that they have people that they have hired to moderate comments, that basically it's going to take time before the technologies manage to get to the point that it needs to with moderation. You are listening to Forward Thinking. We are broadcasting from the Oxford Literary Festival in front of a live audience. My guest is Kerry McInerney. She is an AI ethicist and author of The Good Robot. I want to return to the Internet of Things. Let's delve into that a little bit more.
Yes, sure. So how many of you have ever used Amazon Alexa or similarly any kind of internet device that you have in your home?
I have my hand up. And so does almost everyone in the audience.
These technologies are increasingly ubiquitous, and they're designed to make our lives easier and more straightforward, to help us with small, menial tasks that maybe we don't enjoy. And one of the unexpected and quite difficult side effects of these technologies, though, is that they are unfortunately often used for the purposes of domestic abuse and violence or coercive control.
How?
What they can be used for is to extend a person's or a partner's control over personal space. So if we think about things like smart locks, for example, those can be controlled and used to lock someone in their home.
So this is a lock that can be activated by your phone, I imagine, your smartphone outside of the house?
Yes. So let's say you have one partner who's installed a smart lock on the home, and then the other partner wants to leave or maybe wants to leave that relationship entirely. There can be a physical entrapment there. But there's also more insidious ways that smart home technologies have been documented as perpetrating forms of coercive violence. So, for example, smart thermostats being used to repeatedly raise and lower the temperature in a home and make the person inside really uncomfortable. And you might think, okay, that doesn't sound like the biggest deal, but there's something really scary if you're in these coercive relationships about not having control over your space. And you also just might not understand what's happening.
I suppose it's also the question about whether the ramifications of smart apps was thought about before launch.
I would guess, for example, the teams developing things said, okay, well, we have to make sure that the tool can't be hacked by an outsider, because then that outsider would get access to all this data, and that's really sensitive and really worrying. But maybe what they haven't done is thought about, okay, well, what if the actual dangerous person is not the person outside the home, but it's the person inside the home? And this is a really important insight from years and years of feminist activism, which is that often women and girls are in the most danger from the people who are closest to them. And so I think a really tangible example of this, those little apps which track when you spend money, so that, you know, you get a little notification saying, okay, you've spent $10 buying a sandwich for lunch, which seems very innocuous, and it can be quite helpful for tracking your own spending. But if you're tracking a partner's spending, for example, in a coercive relationship, then that becomes not only really controlling, but also potentially quite dangerous. Because what if someone's trying to talk to someone in order to leave? Or let's say that maybe they've booked a hotel somewhere.
You say wider society needs to be involved, not always technical workarounds. Why do you say that?
Sometimes when we treat these as a problem that are only to do with the technology, we miss the broader kinds of knowledge and approaches we're going to need from sociologists, from psychologists, from educationalists, from people who are working in lots of different domains of society and much better understand why these problems are emerging in the first place and what can be done to stop it. I would be interested, for example, in how many people making generative AI tools for education have actually worked with teachers. Do they know what a teacher actually needs in the classroom space? Are they making something that is going to help teachers or something that's just going to stress teachers out more because it's another thing they have to learn? And I think sometimes the pace of tech development outstrips what's happening on a societal level because technologists are so excited or because they can make a lot of money making these tools, but they've not really thought about whether or not these tools are meeting a need or creating more problems.
How would you define generative AI?
So generative AI, I would define as a subset of machine learning tools which can take a large data set of inputs and then reorganize and band together and create outputs which are not exactly unique because they're created from these composite data sets, but they can create something based on a prompt that looks relatively new. And it's an impressive piece of technology, or it's an impressive jump forward in machine learning techniques. At the same time, I think it does raise a lot of questions, not only about things like copyright and creativity, but also what this means for the future of a lot of jobs, the future of our societies in different ways. And so it's created, I think, a whole host of ethical questions.
Well, let's get into some of those ethical questions. I mean, do you believe generative AI is neutral or sexist or racist?
I think generative AI tools carry the same kinds of biases and misconceptions of the world with the data sets that they're trained on. And I think the danger of generative AI tools is that people will start to treat them as a site of truth. Rest of World, the journalist platform, did this big investigative study on how are people of different nationalities portrayed through Midjourney, which is an image generator tool. And they found that images of people from around the world were incredibly narrow. So for example, they would ask it to generate an Indian man or an Indian person, I think was actually the prompt. And Midjourney, I think 99 times out of 100, produced an elderly Indian man, and that was an Indian person. Or for a Mexican person, they would produce a man wearing a sombrero. For an American person, they almost always pictured a white woman with very long blonde hair standing in front of an American flag. And so I think we have to ask, you know, if generative AI is going to reduce the world down to stereotypes in this way, is this something we actually want? Do we want to see the world in even smaller and narrower ways, or do we want to see it in bigger and more expansive ways?
So it's the data that is inputted that is creating that end effect that you talk about there. So how do you change the data that's been put into the systems that's coming up with these images, pictures, biases, if we want to call it that?
I think the problem goes beyond the data as well. It goes from who's making the technologies, which in the AI industry is notoriously undiverse, through to why the technologies are being made. So I think often there's this fetishization of like more and more data, or people will say this tool is the best one and it's fantastic because we've trained it on this huge data set. And I think what some of the most interesting feminist projects in this space have done is they've taken a very small data set and they've managed to produce something that's actually really good at what it's intended to do. They're thought smaller and a bit more locally. So I worked with Priyanka Swami, who's an anti-female genital cutting activist in India, and she created an app which was designed specifically to help users have difficult conversations about female genital cutting and be able to practice those with a chatbot before having them with friends and family. And I think that's actually a really good example of taking a very small data set and a small community of users and creating something that was really contextually appropriate.
I guess the feeling I get sometimes is that the genie is already out of the bottle.
It does make sense, the way of thinking about generative AI tools, in terms of the massive jumps we've seen in the last couple of years. And certainly, I felt a little bit discouraged as someone who works in AI ethics when ChatGPT came out, because it felt like there had been a turn in public opinion from being super skeptical about these tools to suddenly being really, really excited.
Do you want to explain ChatGPT for those that haven't?
Yeah. So ChatGPT is a large language model. So it's if you type in a prompt, you get a text response, and it's created by OpenAI. And I think what was really interesting about the release of ChatGPT anecdotally is that before its release, there were a lot of concerns about the ethics of large language models in the community I come from. This was very much a hot button issue. And then suddenly I couldn't go anywhere, to any dinner party, to any coffee, without being asked about these large language models. I don't know if you all experienced this as well. Those of you who
are nodding heads. Yes, yes. You feel with ChatGPT then that the public was becoming enamored with it.
Yes, whereas I think, say, in 2020, there was this rising skepticism towards some of the technologies that in the early 2010s have been touted as being these really fantastic new tools. So we were seeing huge protests against facial recognition technology, particularly when used for policing. We were seeing massive protests against the A-level algorithm in the UK, an algorithm that was used to automatically generate predicted grades for students during COVID who couldn't take their exams, but then turned out to carry with it a lot of the classist, discriminatory practices of the British education system. And so I think there was this sense in which people were really getting attuned to the ways that algorithms could amplify existing injustices and inequalities in the world. And then ChatGPT came out and people understandably were very, very excited. But I think it's now only really getting back to a point where people are doubling down again on this more critical approach to these tech companies.
I'm curious with our audience that is here, well, we have some questions for us. Let me go. I'll come to you in just one second. I'm just curious, are you excited by AI with tools such as ChatGPT? Could I have a show of hands? Excited? No. Fearful or concerned? Yeah, that's most of the people. Okay, let us get some questions from our audience. Hello, I'll get your name and where you're from.
Hi, my name is Hannah. I'm from Florida. I've done science and tech reporting for the MIT Tech Review and the New York Times, and now I'm here at Oxford. And my friend and I are trying to revive the feminist society at our college, and the idea is that, like, how do we get the engineer dude bro who thinks, you know, he hears feminism and he like cringes. Like, how do we convince him that feminist theory can be useful for his discipline?
One half of the work that I've done, say, with computer scientists or with engineers has been with people who are often really receptive to the idea of wanting to make technology that is better, more robust, safer, and more equal, but who don't necessarily see any connection between feminist thinking and the work that they're doing. So to give an example, I spent a couple of years talking to engineers at a big tech company, and they'd say, oh, well, you know, there's no problem to do with bias with my particular project because I don't do anything with people. I do anything with people's data. To which I would say, oh, okay, well, out of interest, what do you use? Like, what data set are you drawing on? And they'd say, oh, well, the data set comes from Wikipedia. To which I'd say, oh, well, you know, who writes Wikipedia pages? Where do they come from? We know there's really, really substantial gender disparities on Wikipedia in terms of who writes pages, who gets pages written about them, even the kinds of language that's used on Wikipedia. So I find examples like this, not trying to sort of call out people who don't think their work is gendered, but illustrative examples can be quite helpful to show that often there's a group of engineers and computer scientists who, it's not that they don't care, but they just don't necessarily see their connection to the problem. The other path, I guess, is with people who might really genuinely not be interested in this at all, and they don't see a place for it in their discipline. I tend to approach this in a kind of under the surface way. So I come in talking about AI ethics and I joke that I talk about AI in order to talk about sexism and racism. But more broadly, I think actually this is one of the, I guess, only good things about this particular hype-filled moment around AI and the ethics of AI is that it's much easier to engage a lot of people in a conversation about AI than it is necessarily to straight up engage them in a conversation about feminism. And yet you can bring them on to the same issues or you can bring them into quite a similar space.
Is that helpful, Hannah? Are you going to go in maybe not using the word feminism, I think, is what I'm hearing, to sometimes get people on board?
Feminist society is how they like give us money. So I think that like changing the name might complicate that. But I think your point is really good that our lives are so digital now that to talk about AI, you have to talk about societal issues. And I think those are two ways to like loop people in that might not be immediately receptive. So thank you for that.
Yeah. And if I can just say really quickly on that as well, you know, I do believe in using the word feminism, as you can tell from both of these.
I did not mean to put that in your mouth. It was more as a joke, but yeah. I take your point.
I mean, sometimes I'm like, let's find a way, you know, but I think it's really interesting because I remember talking to the authors of the book called Data Feminism, Catherine D'Ignazio and Lauren Klein, and they said they were really pushed by their publisher to call it data justice. Or they were saying, why do you have to call it data feminism?
This is one episode that we're doing in our series of forward thinking. Another was on Can Veganism Save the Planet? And one of the contributors had talked about the word vegan sometimes turning people off and to use whole plant food instead. So it's just interesting in the sense of communication and what turns people on or off. Kerry McInerney is my guest. She is an AI ethicist, and you're listening to Forward Thinking from the BBC World Service. Our conversation will continue on whether feminism can fix the internet in just a few minutes' time.
Leute, es wird unangenehm, denn ich muss euch einfach fragen, habt ihr euch eigentlich schon mal um eure Versicherung gekümmert? Hier ist übrigens Tara vom Podcast Tara sagt was und ich sage euch, es wird allerhöchste Zeit, Ordnung in euer Versicherungschaos zu bringen und dabei kann euch die App Clark helfen. Da arbeiten ganz viele Expertinnen, die das hauptberuflich machen, man glaubt es kaum. Und mit meinem Code TARA60, alles groß und zusammengeschrieben, könnt ihr euch sogar einen Shopping-Gutschein sichern, 60 Euro, bei zum Beispiel Amazon oder Douglas einlösbar, mit dem Code TARA60.
Cataracts are the world's leading cause of avoidable blindness. The Metaverse can help address that problem. A virtual reality platform created by Fundamental VR and Orbis International, helps train doctors to treat cataracts, resulting in more confident surgeons operating all over the world. With virtual reality training, surgeons can practice over and over to gain skills. Meta and the Metaverse are having impact today.
From the BBC World Service, this is the documentary podcast at the Oxford Literary Festival. I'm Nuala McGovern. My guest this hour is AI ethicist Kerry McInerney, who is thinking about the question, can feminism fix the internet? We have questions that have come in from all around the world, as well as our live audience that is here in the room with us. And I want to turn to Ash from Melbourne, when it came to how might you make the internet and being online a better place to be?
AI-based content moderation would have less bias than human moderators exhibit. It would also be immediate, so inappropriate content would be zapped straight away.
What about this concept, Kerry, that if you had AI-based moderation, that it would take the bias out of it?
To me, I can see the allure in it because content moderation done by human moderators is very exploitative. It can be very emotionally damaging to those people, and it's often really underpaid. So I can see people saying, okay, well, you know, let's get an AI program tool to do it. I don't know if it would necessarily remove the bias per se, because again, I think there is this tendency to treat AI-powered tools as though they're inherently neutral or better than humans when it comes to doing things in non-discriminatory ways. I don't think that's always the case. I think what's very, very challenging, though, about AI-powered content moderation is that understanding what is hateful content, understanding what is discriminatory content is incredibly contextual. This is, again, why we need people who understand what constitutes hateful speech in relation to a particular community, because it's always evolving. And people who say hateful things online, who propagate hate speech, often do it in very innovative ways to escape forms of moderation.
And I want to talk about that as well. I want to thank Ash, who is one of the people, a BBC World Service listener, who posted on our Facebook page. We have lots of people who got in touch on our various digital platforms. I have another one from Dan. And this comes back to moderation in a way. I suppose really who's responsible for making the place at times such a nasty place to be. He says the internet is just one giant wake-up call to what people are really thinking because there's less repercussions for what they say. Keyboard warriors, for example, won't be bonked on the nose for something offensive that they've said to somebody. It's as simple as that. But how do you change that behaviour?
My understanding of this is it's, I guess, pushing towards what it means for us to suddenly be exposed to so much more information and so many more views that maybe many of us wouldn't have experienced before. And there can be really wonderful sides to that level of information exposure. For example, I benefit from this every day when I get to, say, talk to family members across the globe or learn more about topics I'm interested in. But there is something that can be really devastating and overwhelming about that. It's something I think about a lot as I feel like my generation, for context, I'm 29. I grew up in Auckland, New Zealand as a multiracial person. And I feel like I'm almost the last generation of people who will have grown up with the sense of their racial identity before the internet, because now the internet so profoundly shapes how I think about my own race, my own ethnicity. And there's strengths to that. I feel like I developed a language for talking about race and racism that I didn't have before. And yet there's also limitations to that. I think it's a very Americanized language. And so there was a long period of time where I was learning a rhetoric about race that completely made sense in one very culturally specific context, the US, but didn't necessarily make sense in New Zealand, where I'm from. At the same time, I think offensiveness is a really difficult parameter to use around what kind of content we should allow to proliferate online and what kind of content we shouldn't. I often prefer to think about this rather than offensiveness, which I think is very individualized, and that puts a lot of onus on the individual or the victim to show why they were offended and why the defense was okay. More to try and think broadly about things like harm or coercion. So saying, actually, if you make this broad claim about women, or if you make this broad claim about different minoritized groups, like, what does that do? What does that normalize? And again, this is where I think feminist principles are really helpful, because there's a long history of thinking about how the things people say and do can be harmful to individuals, but also more broadly be really harmful at the societal level.
It's interesting. I have another comment here, and I'd be curious for your thoughts on it. It's from Kareem Waheed, another listener, BBC listener, who got in touch. Long story short, talking about, can the internet be a nicer, safer place? You can't. Just like you can't make the real world safer until humanity becomes more logical, kind and compassionate, change has to come from within, not enforced. And that was repeated so many times that there had to be, that change had to happen in society before we were ever going to see it online.
I completely empathize with one of the driving ideas behind that comment, this idea that the reason why we have so much terrible behavior online is driven hugely by the kinds of systemic inequalities we have in our society, and what kinds of online behavior we implicitly or explicitly condone, and that we say, well, this is just something you have to deal with if you're a woman online. And I'm sure many of us have heard that. What I would say, though, is this is where I think it's incredibly important to have stronger regulation, to have more pressure on big tech, is that there are things that platforms do and don't do that do play an active role in creating this hostile environment. Amnesty International did reports where they looked at the genocide of Rohingya people in Myanmar in 2017, and they looked at the genocide in Ethiopia of Tigray people. And in both those cases, they concluded that Meta had ultimately absolutely failed in its recognition and moderation of hate speech. And that in countries like Myanmar, and this is quoting directly, I think, from the UN special study on this, where Facebook is the internet, Meta actually did then play a really significant role in that act of violence. And in the Ethiopian case, Meta only could moderate, or they'd only invested in moderation for 4 of the over 80 languages spoken in Ethiopia. So they literally didn't even have the infrastructure to provide the level of moderation required. So that's when I say, well, yes, human behavior is definitely driving this and is ultimately where the agency lies. But there's a lot of things platforms could be doing very, very differently.
And I don't have a response from Meta on that particular aspect. But I do want to just amplify what you're saying with a comment that came into us from Mutinta in Zambia, a BBC listener.
Have a team with knowledge of all the languages in the world. This way, I feel the internet will become a safe place. Unlike the current situation where we have people threatening in their language and the internet having no control over that.
Has big tech talked about having more language experts, more moderation in different parts of the world? I mean, when we think about how many languages there are in the world as well.
Language is a huge, huge area where there needs to be a lot more investment by big tech if they want to meaningfully globalize in a way that is ethical. I think right now we see companies stretching across the world and saying we'll create, in the case of Meta, right, like a 3 billion community of users, but they're not actually putting the ethical safeguards in place that they need. I think some of the most effective activism I've seen around this has actually been by grassroots organizations. So there's a grassroots organization called Masakana, which aims to bring some of the many thousands of African languages that exist into natural language processing. But that's almost entirely driven by people's own activism.
And natural language processing?
Yes. So this is the process that is really central to things like ChatGPT, large language models. And so again, the databases upon which these models are trained tend to be English language databases. So they're already products which make sense in one part of the world, but don't necessarily make sense in a lot of other parts of the world.
And I was reading as well that there was a UNESCO report particularly talking about gender-based violence in a technology setting. And it says women in the global south represent a particularly vulnerable community. Why is that?
I think one of the reasons is these infrastructural gaps. So saying we've not actually tried to meet different language needs or different cultural and contextual needs, which explains like why someone might be experiencing forms of gender-based violence. I think another aspect of this relates to different kinds of political activism. There are incredible, vibrant feminist movements in many places across the global South. And unfortunately, people who are public-facing feminists, who are feminist journalists, who are doing this incredible work, tend to then be really, really vulnerable to forms of hate speech, to being profiled online. I think, believe it's a Ugandan policy think tank, it's also called Policy, but with two L's, looked specifically at how Ugandan female politicians were harassed online during the Ugandan elections. And I think, unfortunately, that's a story that gets repeated all over the world. And it is either Uganda or Rwanda has the highest number of female MPs.
Rwanda
has the highest female MPs. And so, you know, I think there's also something about, again, that female presence in parliament being kind of very public facing, which makes you, on the one hand, doing this incredible transformative political work, unfortunately also makes you quite vulnerable to online abuse.
A potential target. Let's get some more questions from our audience here in the room. I should also say you're listening to Forward Thinking from the BBC World Service. My guest is Kerry McInerney, AI ethicist, as we talk about whether feminism can fix the internet. Hi.
Hi, I'm Katie. My background is in innovation and early stage product design. One of the challenges that I see is typically when we start to ask questions around equity and around accessibility to make that product part of a fairer world, the bit that we get stuck on is return on investment and actually what are investors going to want to invest in. So I'm interested to get your views on, in order to fix the internet or to fix the platform and products that are coming out, what feminist lens would you like to see coming into the world of investment and finance?
Again, I would see multiple routes here. Like, I do think one of the big kind of background questions is, should we be scaling certain products environmentally and socially? Are we actually meant to have technologies that are this big? But to come to your direct question, I would see sort of two additional routes. I think the first would be addressing the kind of huge gender gaps in financing and investment. And this is a persistent problem for women in technology or people trying to do feminist work in tech, is the lack of investment and trying to think about how does sexism and gender shape which kinds of products get funding. But then the second is just to say, I think there's some really interesting, very practical feminist work, which is going on right now, which is thinking about that product development stage and what kinds of checks people can use when they're trying to bring a project to fruition and say, what does it mean to make sure that our tools are not only not discriminatory or just compliant, but are actively trying to make the world a little bit better.
I want to bring another listener in. This is Christian Grams from Germany, who got in touch online with the BBC World Service. And as we asked the question, how can we make being online a better place to be? This was his answer.
One, stop the anonymity. Everybody needs to be clearly and correctly identifiable. Two, all laws in the corresponding country of the victim stroke plaintiff that exist in the real world need to be enforced internationally.
So that first one, that came up again and again, Kerry, like, don't let people be anonymous online. Is that feasible?
I understand again where this is coming from, because I think we've all probably experienced someone we don't know, a stranger, coming in and, you know, making comments about us or having maybe things to say that we don't agree with. I think the problem with removing anonymity online, I'd say, is twofold. The first is that, unfortunately, the forcible removing of people's anonymous status, or like doxing, where you reveal people's personal attributes online or their address, things like that, is a really primary form of technology-mediated gender-based violence. And so my worry is that the people who are most likely to suffer from having this removed are going to be people who are already most vulnerable, because what happens to activists, what happens to dissidents if we say, actually, you can't assume a persona online? So I think this is something that is well-intended but would have really, really far-reaching political consequences.
It's interesting. It came up so many times from all around the world. And the second part that Christian talks about there, that the laws in the corresponding country of the victim, plaintiff, if they exist in the real world, would need to be enforced internationally. I mean, this, I was thinking of in the UK, they just brought in a law recently about cyber flashing. So that is the sending of unwanted images of genitals. And it was primarily to women and girls that were affected by this. But it was with the intent, it was very specific, to cause humiliation or for sexual gratification. Somebody got sentenced for the first time recently. But that took a long time to come to reflect what the laws would have been, we'd say, in the real world if somebody came up and had exposed themselves to a person. Because it's kind of the Wild West online at times, and the things that people can do there or say there, they wouldn't do it if they were sitting opposite you, hopefully.
Often it isn't as simple as there are kinds of violence that only happen online and there's kinds of violence that only happen offline. Often it's this integration of the two. So there's this sense of, say, oh, okay, someone has put my personal details online and now people are ringing my actual house, right? Or it's someone's made a death threat or a sexual violence related threat to me online, but now I'm very scared in like the physical space of my own home. I think this also though raises this broader question of like one of the difficulties in a regulatory sense is that so much onus is placed or responsibility and agency is placed on the companies who run the platforms as though this is almost like their own kind of sovereign space. And that is really, really bizarre, especially when we think about it, as this comment says, internationally as well. Like, why should an American company have jurisdiction over something that's happening in another place in the world?
And of course, we've seen, and this is more US focused, but we've seen those hearings that have taken place in the US Congress not that long ago with the Mark Zuckerberg, who's the CEO of Facebook, or Meta, as it is known now, and with other tech leaders. But there still doesn't seem to be a solution for exactly where the responsibility lies, or indeed how it might be legislated and whether legislation would be a way that would stop the harassment or indeed some of the other cyber crimes or cyber violence that you talk about taking place. Who profits from online shaming or humiliation?
Yes. And again, this is another issue with this idea of removing anonymity as a solution, because some people make all their money by being these very public, hateful figures. And you might say, okay, well, there's a performative element, or this is a persona someone's having online, creating. But when people are selling themselves through authenticity, that then becomes, you know, a more difficult question. So I think in terms of who profits, I think firstly, again, big tech through this attention economy. They want you to click more. They want you to engage more. And attempts supposedly to change that model, say with like Meta moving towards meaningful social interaction, hasn't really worked. I would say as well, it's also very, very commercialized. When we think about platforms like TikTok, this is less to do with shaming, but more, I think, just to do with influencing. I'm always struck just how perfectly that platform is designed to sell you things, and particularly things you don't even need.
You needed.
Yeah, exactly. I never knew what a Stanley Cup was till like last year, and then they were everywhere.
Let's tell our listener who has not seen the Stanley Cup yet, that has the algorithm, hasn't caught up with them yet.
It's just this huge insulated cup, as long as like my forearm. I don't know why you want one or need one, but TikTok continues to aggressively market them to me. And the reason why I flagged this is because I think there are a lot of really awful ways that big tech very overtly benefits from and profits from forms of online shaming. But we've also seen kind of some really sad kind of blurring of the offline online worlds, kinds of profiting and shaming happening. And this is just, you know, I joke about the Stanley Cup, but anecdotally people saying like, well, my child's now being bullied at school because she doesn't have a Stanley Cup. And now I've got to decide, do I buy this horrifically expensive, very large cup that's half her body size, because otherwise she's going to be socially ostracized? Or another example that I hadn't really thought about is children who are called the name Alexa, or there's been this big movement by people called Alexa, and that name has actually really dropped off baby naming to try and claim their name back from this tool, because they're treated often in these very sexist and demeaning ways.
I've had a conversation with Alexis on that. I have. And they says people come up, hey, Alexa, can you get me a drink? Hey, Alexa. Gosh. I want to go back to some meaningful social interaction questions in our audience. Right. Let's get a few before we finish up our program. Let's fly through.
Hi.
What's your name?
My name is Laura. I'm from Romania. My background is in comparative literature. And being an ACCA fan, I was just wondering, with fanfiction being such a feminist-led space, how would you feel like AI would be able to make this space or community more safe?
Specifically intersecting with fanfiction, or just if you could elaborate a little bit?
Communities overall, but especially with ChatGPT being a language model, speaking into the fanfiction space, how would it make it safer maybe?
And is it not safe at the moment, just for us that don't do fan fiction as much, just to be super clear?
It is, as long as it's contained.
Okay. Yeah, those smaller communities that find themselves, is there a way perhaps for them to be safe, where it's kind of a specialized group maybe that find themselves in various spaces? Is fan fiction quite male-based?
No, it is actually a feminist-led space.
Okay, that's interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I will premise this by saying I'm definitely not an expert in the fan fiction space, but I find it a really, really interesting space because I think it really almost embodies or captures a lot of the best and the worst of the internet. Like, from what I see of fan fictions, it can be an incredible space for particularly queer people or gender non-conforming people to write and tell and explore different kinds of stories that are often not at all supported by mainstream publishing. And yet at the same time, there's also a lot of problems and vulnerabilities. And like, when it comes to people writing fan fiction, I get particularly worried when there's a lot of minors, for example, in that community who maybe are interacting with people who aren't minors. There's a lot of safeguarding issues that I think maybe aren't necessarily being thought through. And this is, I think, particularly troubling when it comes to, yeah, like a lot of fan fiction that might be about sex or be erotic. And, you know, I think that there's layers and layers of different kinds of power that we need to think about when it comes to making those spaces safer for people. One of the things that worries me a little bit about large language models is I really worry that fan fiction, because it's this free archive, is being scraped and used to train large language models. And I worry that that makes the people who write these stories maybe potentially unsafe or might, you know, potentially threaten their own position online. Because I know for some people, writing fan fiction is something that they're very open about. For other people, it's very much like a quiet, closed practice, and it's important to them, but it's not something they necessarily want to share. So I think there's, you know, potentially issues there with safety, potentially issues also there just with, you know, if this is your own written work, why should companies be able to scrape it in that way? That's not what it was intended for. So that's not really a prescription how to make it safer. That's more just like some of my concerns.
How would you describe fan fiction?
So fan fiction, I would describe it as stories that people have written based on pre-existing franchises. So it might be Harry Potter or Twilight, where they're maybe taking some of the ideas or some of the characters from those stories, but they're making it their own and they're telling their own work. And usually they say very clearly at the beginning of these stories, like, this is not copyright infringement, like, this is just being done as a kind of form of play or exploration. But there's also quite an interesting pipeline between people who write fan fiction stories that are using that, I guess, to train up their own authorly style, and then they actually turn that into original work. And so I believe a number of different quite popular novels, from 50 Shades of Grey through to, I think, potentially After, I'm thinking about books that are big on TikTok, I think originally started out their lives as fan fiction.
So interesting. So interesting. I saw somebody else out there. Yes, a gentleman with the yellow sweater, and then I'll come to the gentleman with the blue sweater. Hi, what's your name? Where are you from?
Hi, I'm Alex. I'm from China originally. I guess my question was related to all your imaginations of sort of alternative futures linked with different technologies. I think one of the things that's really interesting about emerging technologies is that it helps us to imagine alternative transformative futures. So my question is, what do you think is wrong with the way currently we imagine futures with AI, and how feminism can help us imagine a sort of better future with AI, with this exciting but also sort of worrying technology?
Yes, getting to some of perhaps the potential solutions that we might think about with a more feminist lens on AI. Thank you, Alex.
Yeah, I love that question. And this is something I think about a lot, because one of the big problems I have with a lot of the way that we talk about AI, both by big tech companies, but also by countries and their national AI strategies, things like that, is the value lock-in, or this idea of they're locking us into a particular vision of an AI-powered future, which often involves AI being deployed at scale. It might involve a future of trying to get the most productive work. And I just think that these aren't necessarily values that we should take for granted. And so I see feminist writing and thinking as this really valuable imaginative resource for thinking differently. So one area that I really love is feminist science fiction, or I read and explore a lot of science fiction written by people who are deliberately trying to disrupt this like westernized Terminator narrative and say, okay, how do we live with and alongside technology instead? So I think the Monk and Robot series is a really interesting example
of this. What is that?
I think the first one's called A Psalm for the Wild Built. And it's a series which is imagining, you know, a monk and a robot just coexisting and living with each other very peacefully. And stories like that are really common outside of this Hollywood science fiction canon. But for a lot of us who are maybe brought up in English-speaking countries, our way that we imagine our futures with technology tends to be on either this model of dominance and submission mm-hmm. or of mastery. And it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. Another kind of speculative project that I love is the Indigenous AI Protocol, which contains within it a lot of different kinds of speculative projects, which are trying to imagine forms of technology that are really culturally specific. Everything from, say, and biotech eel through to using the kinds of cultural practices you use to create a fishing net as a way of designing algorithms. And I think these are really wonderful projects because they're so specific and so culturally located.
And so brain stimulating, right, as we think about them. Thank you so much for your question. Thank you, Kerry McInerney, for your answer. I have one more question down here with this gentleman with the blue jumper. I think you're going to be our last questioner. What is your name and where are you from?
I'm Guy from Oxford. Who ultimately should be held accountable and therefore prosecutable for AI material that does harm or causes people to do harm to themselves or to others?
This, I think, is the golden question, and it is so tricky. When it comes down to it, in the short term, responsibility, I think, lies with both the people who are actively creating and propagating the content and also the platforms that refuse to stop disseminating it or who have created products and brought them to market without necessarily putting those safeguards in place. But in the long term, I think, and again, this is where I think feminist work is so important, something we're going to have to do is try to think about what it means to build societies that aren't necessarily just based on reactive punishment when it comes to gender-based violence more broadly, but in particularly technology-mediated gender-based violence. And I'm reading The Right to Sex at the moment by an Oxford philosopher, so bringing it close to home. And something that the author says that I really love is talking about the need to move beyond these models of punishment. As she says, you know, something that we have to do as feminists is we have to be better and more imaginative than men have previously been and how they've created our systems. And that's something I hold really true when it comes to also thinking about what it means to have better relationships with each other through technology.
I'm Nuala McGovern. You've been listening to Forward Thinking, an edition of the documentary podcast from the BBC World Service. The producer was Julian Siddle. Thanks so much to my guest, Kerry McInerney, who's an AI ethicist, and our live audience right here at the Oxford Literary Festival.
If you had the chance to win a life-changing amount of money, you'd go for it, right? Oh, but it's televised and you can't trust anyone. I'm Ella Alshamahi, one of the new presenters of The Conversation from the BBC World Service. We speak to incredible women from different parts of the world about their shared experiences. Join me for a special episode which finds out what really goes on behind the scenes with reality TV contestants from The Traitors and Survivor. Search for The Conversation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.